Come, spellweavers, reavers, rogues, and men-at-arms, and answer the call of adventure. Pick up your sword, your axe, your spellbook, your bow, your rulebook, and your dice, and join the forces of good in their eternal fight against vile monsters, conspiring min-maxers, horny bards, and blood-soaked murder hobos. Discover the treasure trove of role-playing games here on Rollin' Bones. My name is Ryan Howard, and I shall be your guide. Good evening, boneheads, and welcome back to Rollin' Bones with Ryan Howard, where we are making old school young again. I'm your host and king of the boneheads, Ryan Howard, and this evening is going to be a lot of fun. This will be the last episode that we do of the year, and I can think of no better way to celebrate the holidays than by talking to Ginger Frazier and young Steve Buscemi from Black Lodge Games about their background in role-playing, a little bit about Vampire, and of course, about Candela Obscura. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you see over here on Rollin' Bones. Also want to remind everyone that you can find me on all kinds of social media, but mostly over on X and Instagram at Howard_RyanGregg. Twitch is twitch.tv/RollinBonesRyan. And Substack is rollinbones.substack.com. Of course, you can find me here on YouTube at Rollin' Bones. Substack has been popping off lately. I've really been enjoying the feedback that I've been getting from Substack. Just the other day, my father told me that my last two articles were exemplary. So take that for what it is, and I hope you guys will check those out. And also want to remind everyone that if you want to support Rollin' Bones, you can do so by buying some of our merch over on TeePublic. You can find that link here in chat as well. And we got some cool designs over there. Hope you guys enjoy some of that stuff. And as always, the best way to support Rollin' Bones is just to like, share, and subscribe. Tell people that we're out there. Share these links with your friends. Definitely want to get more people watching Rollin' Bones in 2024. And I am so grateful for those of you who join me on a regular basis. I can't do this without you guys. Coming up on 5 years of Rollin' Bones. Thank you for those of you who've been with me from the very beginning. Anyway, I want to remind everyone to check out Black Lodge Games over on YouTube. You'll find that link here in chat as well. You can find them on X over at Black Lodge Games. And so without further ado, let's go ahead and bring them on. They don't know what to do with those tossed salads and scrambled eggs, and they're also out of their element. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ginger Frazier and young Steve Buscemi, Black Lodge Games.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Oh, no problem. I'm glad that you guys were able to come on tonight, especially it's kind of short notice, but you know, I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, me too.
Same.
Yeah. So every time we bring people on to Rollin' Bones for the first time, there's a couple questions everyone gets asked. I really want to cut to the heart of the matter here. Those of us who dedicate a lot of time and energy to thinking about and playing these games, we do so because we love the game, and that love comes from fond memories that we have. So if you guys had to pick fondest RPG memories, what would those be for you?
Oh, man. For me, it was a game I ran about a decade ago that's on YouTube. That it was the final session. We had a TPK, and it wasn't because they got like wiped by monsters or enemies. It's because the players all killed each other because they their characters. We were playing a game called Within the Ring of Fire that is the different species and races in that game do not get along. Like they're each created by different gods, and some of them are like have genocidal holy crusades against each other. You know, the sorts of things like the god of nightmares and the god of tranquil dreams don't get along. And so we had a lot of characters that were playing incompatible species. I was able to kind of like force them through this crucible and got their, they had a reason to stick together for a very long time, but they were really, really into the role play, and it all unraveled at the very end.
In the best way.
In the best way possible. I mean, it was like, character, there was this like love triangle where every, like going on, and like they're like murder. It was awesome. So it was a game that has lived in my mind and the minds of the players for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I would definitely echo not that game specifically, but or that campaign you ran, that time, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 years ago, whenever it was, when Within the Ring of Fire had just came out, it was sort of the first iteration of the YouTube RPG Brigade, and it was a really special time in YouTube and also in my gaming career, you might say. A lot of people were talking about immersive roleplay, which we talk a lot about as well.
Incessantly.
Yeah, incessantly. Really informed a lot of what I had been intuiting, but maybe didn't have the words for, or didn't know that other people felt the same way I did or wanted to play in that way. And it was just a really cool, like, boiling pot of creativity.
Yeah.
A lot of excellent games, some that I ran, a bunch that I played in.
Mm-hmm.
Very special time.
Mm-hmm.
Fine.
Gotcha. And of course, we will save the big question for the very end of the show. But one thing I wanted to talk about before we kind of dive into the heart of the matter here tonight, we kind of share a background in how we got interested in role-playing games and kind of how we approach role-playing games. And hate to break it to those of you who don't know, but all three of us here, myself included, are dirty theater kids. So
I actually
am. He's not. I am.
Two of us are dirty theater kids.
Yeah.
And as Meatloaf has told us, two out of three ain't bad.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, Ginger Frazier, was the pipeline like theater directly into role-playing? Was that kind of how you
ended up in this world? Actually, honestly, the other direction.
Okay.
Because I am the youngest in my family, and I had two older brothers that had been playing D&D in the 80s and 90s. And so I got introduced to it in like probably the mid 90s. Cause I was probably like 10 or 11 or so when my brother finally let me play like one time. So we had a bunch of the second edition books, a lot of Palladium books that as everyone has experienced, our mother threw away a long time ago. Yeah. Unforgivable. And we even had a 1E Dungeon Master's Guide that I tried to read and didn't really get much out of because I was too young. But I was like obsessed because I would watch my brother, especially my older brother Tim, who was only a couple of years ahead of me. He and his friends, when they were in middle school and high school, they'd come over and they'd just play for hours and hours and hours. I was fascinated by it. So I got really, really into it, really started playing at the very end of the 2E era with my friends. One of my friends ran like the Diablo 2 official D&D nice. Module that came out at the time. That was a lot of fun. And then when I got into high school, I met my friend Matt in theater class, and he got me into Vampire the Masquerade, and that was a wrap for me with D&D for a long time.
Hell yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I guess it really was kind of the other direction. I liked playing pretend, and I decided that I got to take a class about that in school and then studied pretend in college.
I was also a pretend major in college for a very brief amount of time, but then I discovered that my college, they had a theater program, but their whole thing was basically screw the actors. And so I was just like, what am I going to be? You're going to teach me how to light up the stage and put sets on it, but we're not going to have, I don't know, people acting on the stage that we just dressed up here. That's the afterthought.
Yeah. Well, I had my theater tech instructor in college. I remember one time he told a story about one of the actors because he thought that the tech side never got enough love. And he had an actor come into the shop one time and ask him, is it going to look like that? And so then he went into the acting class while he was acting and said, are you going to say it that way on the day? Like while he was rehearsing. and then they had this kind of blowout fight where he's like, he's saying, I don't think actors are artists. And the kid's freaking out on him. He's like, well, why not? Why not? And he goes, well, you're standing on a stage that someone else built with a set that someone else built under lights that someone else designed, saying words that someone else wrote for you. So I don't think you're really yeah. doing a whole lot here.
Oh, man. That's the...
He's got a point.
Yeah. that guy was a maniac. He was awesome.
That's like the actor Spurg cheat code.
Yeah.
that combination of words right there is just... If you want apoplexia from an actor, just yeah. like spit out those words. Not even necessarily in that order. Just... But Crafty Matt actually is bringing something up here. It says actors make terrible role players. I actually disagree with that. And for a while, like when I came into role playing games, it was in 5e, and that's a bad combination of theater kid with 5e.
Yeah,
just because of what 5e encourages.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I've discovered as I've gotten into running games rules as written, into really diving into rule sets and kind of following the way, or, you know, whatever you want to call this mode of role playing that we've all kind of, you know, found ourselves falling into. When you're acting, you have your script, and your script mm-hmm. is the reality that like this, that's the totality of your truth is what's in the script. And you have to basically treat that as your reality for the duration of your performance. You have to react honestly, and you have to embody that world and live in that world. The mm-hmm. rules are the same. The rules, it's not a script, but it's the same concept of the rules yep. are your given circumstances. That's your truth. And yeah. so if you're...
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead. I'm just enthusiastically agreeing with you.
When you commit to a part, the same way when you commit to a game, you're committing to all of the facets of that part, of that rule set. And much like, you know, people like to talk about Robin Williams improv-ing or, you know, whoever doing what on the set of whatever movie. But in reality, if you start just throwing out lines or, you know, going counter to the director or counter to the script, you're going to find yourself in serious trouble as an actor. And it's the same way as a game master or a player if you start trying to circumvent the rules. So I don't see them as necessarily contrary. I just see them as... I think a lot of theater kids misunderstand what role playing is supposed to be, but yes. I do think there's a skill set that lines up very well with role playing.
Yeah, for sure. I kind of, my experience with playing with actors outside of my friend Matt, who I met in high school, who got me into Vampire, has been pretty negative because they're looking, they don't know what to do. Like, mm-hmm. It was very odd. I was playing with one of my friends in college. I was running a game, and she was just staring at the character sheet. I was like, the answer's not there. Like, you just need to make a decision. Like, do something, you know?
Right.
And it was, I figured out later, I was like, it's basically like she didn't have any lines. She didn't have...
Yeah.
Right. No lines, no direction.
Yeah, and didn't know how to play the game, and I didn't explain it all that well. But your point about... knowing the rules and knowing your lines, I 100% agree with that, because in acting, when you learn the lines by rote, so you're at a point where you're not thinking about what's my next line, what's the thing that they're going to like feed me that I play off of. It's you have everything down by rote, and in that, within the kind of boundaries of that, you then actually have a lot of freedom to play around and to actually be spontaneous within this structure. And so the same thing, if everybody at the table knows the rules by rote, and Crafty's talked about this before, but if everybody knows things by rote, the game can just flow. There's not a constant interruption. We talk about this a lot. Like, you kind of basically at least the way we like to play, is you want to be in a flow state. You don't want things constantly disrupting the game. And obviously that means, like, if you have to look up a rule, that's fine, but it's ideal if everybody has the books and has read them and knows enough of it that you don't need to sit for 5-10 minutes at a time looking something up just to resolve one single action, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I completely agree on that. If you have, when you know the structure and you know the boundaries, you can play a lot better.
Yeah. Right.
And yet, I mean, you know, to your point about actors as players being frustrated or being stunned because they don't have any lines, they don't have any direction, they don't have a script. Yeah, this speaks, I think, to something we have spoken about before, which is, you know, rule zero being intentionality.
We're not talking about throw out the rules.
No,
rule zero for running a game is everybody gets on the same page.
Everybody gets on the same page, and are you there to be immersed in a character? And that is the key fundamental step for how we like to play the game. And I haven't encountered any group of people, any profession, that sort of particularly leans heavier in that direction. That seems to be a line that most people are on one side of, because we're all born with the ability and the proficiency to play make-believe.
Yeah.
Right. It's the oldest game. It's something that, you know, there's no resources that are expended. You don't need anything. Ultimately, obviously the rules are important, but when it comes down to it, the key fundamental thing is to have an imagination.
Right.
And most people don't understand that or don't want to do that.
Or don't have an imagination.
Or don't have an imagination who can't visualize the apple.
Yeah.
You know,
I was just about to say,
so when you find someone who is into that, it's like finding, you know, needle in a haystack, diamond in the rough, take your platitude. A rare and precious resource are the role players.
Yep. Now you guys have used the word immersion quite a bit, and at the expense of, or, you know, possibly derailing this, this stream, I've heard a lot of people kind of push back against the idea of immersion. Specifically, I'm surprised he hasn't done so already, if he's watching, Jeffro Johnson will often pop up and say immersion is impossible. And I think a lot of people misuse the word immersion when talking about role-playing games. So I just want to ask you guys, what does that word mean to you in the context of role-playing games?
Well, for us, it is... Immersion is an experience. Let's see, who is it? Primeval Fantasy is a guy on YouTube. He's great. He's talked about this a lot. The experience of other world immersion, where you are essentially for brief moments so invested in the moment, so engaged that it takes on kind of a hyper reality. Like you can feel the experiences of that your character is feeling. The image in your mind is so vivid that for almost a brief moment it takes over.
It all clicks.
It all clicks.
All falls into place.
And we're not speaking like the apple is blocking your vision, you know.
And there he is.
That's
right.
Primeval Fantasy. There he is. Yep. Nice. He also had some excellent Aristotelian videos on role playing recently. But it's basically like getting to the point where the illusion becomes real for these brief moments. And it's not something that you can maintain for, you know, extended like hours at a time or anything like that. It's really being in like the maximum flow state for these just brief peaks. And what we want to do in our games is try to have as many of those peaks as possible and have them last as long as possible. For people who say that immersion is not real, it's like, I have experienced it many times.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know what to tell you. Like,
right.
Yeah. I'm not fully on board with this idea that immersion is impossible. I, I'm not even partially on board. I think there are plenty of times where you can get lost in the game, especially, and for me, I think it does come down to exactly what you guys were talking about and exactly what we were talking about. When you are able to reach that point where your circumstances become your truth.
Yes.
It's fleeting and it's hard.
Yeah.
But it's...
Yeah, it takes effort.
Yeah. It's kind of like playing rules as written. Playing a perfect rules as written game is a process. It's like when we talk about in the Presbyterian Church, when we talk about the process of sanctification. Sanctification is a process over time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So are all of these things.
Yeah.
So is immersion. So is, you know, knowing your rules well enough that you are able to enter a flow state. This is all
right.
It's aspirational and it's something to work towards. It's not something you get immediately. And
100%.
So,
yeah.
Just because it's not immediately achievable doesn't mean it's not worth pursuing.
Exactly.
Yeah, the enjoyment, the engagement, the fulfillment comes in the pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may not get there all session. You know, those things happen. And when you do, they are, like Matt said, they're moments.
And they're magic, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah. And for the rules as written thing, I know a lot of people who I think talk about immersion tend to be the kind of the 5e people and the story gaming kind of thing. And uh-huh. They like to throw out the rules, but mm-hmm. We really do think that the rules make a game. Like, they are the skeleton upon which everything hangs. Like, you can't, and this is why, like, just taking a setting and throwing it into a different system, it fundamentally changes what it is. Like, big time. Mm-hmm. So we definitely don't like throwing rules out. We throw rules out if they are badly designed rules.
Correct.
Yes.
But generally, if we play a new game, we play it as close to raw as we can.
And you don't need to run a game for 30 years to determine whether or not
the rule is good or bad.
These rules are terrible. This is not a rocket engine. These are not, you know, people call the folks who write these role-playing games designers. But this is not an intricate piece of complicated machinery. This is something that if you have greater than a room temperature IQ, if you're even playing these games, you are cognizant enough to determine for yourself whether these rules are well designed or not. Now, that being said, you're going back to intentionality. Of course, we're coming at it from that character immersion perspective, but even for the rules as written crowd, such as it is, or all the different camps who say they want different things out of the hobby. I think for both of us, we're far more willing to show some respect to that if you have thought about why you're advocating for something. Most people say they like something simply as a product of momentum.
Yeah.
Yes.
Almost no one, whether you're in it for character immersion or for tactical combat or to try and rediscover old, maybe forgotten ways of playing or esoteric addendums to the rules. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is you're doing, you should have a clear understanding in your mind why it is you like that, why you're doing this. You have to have some kind of an ethos here.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you are wasting your time.
And your mom was right.
Your mom is right. Yes. You are wasting your time and you're not worthy of any respect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Know what you want.
And that lack of intentionality and that lack of knowing why you're doing what you're doing, it's a concept that I think is kind of very well encapsulated in the problems with Candela Obscura to get us back on that track. But it gets at this thing that I've started calling playing at playing. There are a lot of people in this hobby who basically want to pretend that they play games. They want to be able to tell goofy stories that they see other people tell on the internet, but they don't actually want to interface with any mechanics to get those. Right. They just kind of want to generate them automatically. And so I think a lot of the core problems that you see in Candela Obscura come out of this kind of playing at playing thing that has permeated the hobby so much. And I guess at this point, we kind of have to dig into it. What exactly is wrong with Candela Obscura?
There's, that's a hard question to answer because it is like basically, in my opinion, fractally broken. Like it's not just the rules, because the rules are incomplete and coming at things from the wrong philosophical view on just like, what is the purpose? Like, what is a role-playing game? Like it gets kind of all of that wrong to begin with. But in addition to that, the setting is completely nonsensical and very uninteresting and boring, and they've sucked any sort of meaningful conflict out of it. And on top of that, it's extraordinarily preachy. Like, the game lectures you on every page. But I'd say
the world itself is also a fractal contradiction.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's literally nothing about the world makes any sense.
Right.
Yeah. Like, and not in like I will give credit to I give a lot more credit to the Muppet people of the BroSR in their world building than Candela Obscura at this point. it's a big mess. But the kind of biggest problem with this is that the game is coming at what rules are used for from the wrong perspective. I wasn't aware of the GNS, narrativist and simulationist and gamist. That entire conversation until earlier this year.
It's okay if you're not aware of it. It's complete bullshit.
I mean, I guess. I mean, I look at the simulationist thing and I'm like, that's the correct answer. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly the correct answer.
Yeah, it's clearly the correct answer. Like, and even from our perspective of being the, the character immersion theater kids, it's like, we do that because you treat the world as if it's real. And you need rules that adjudicate the outcomes within whatever genre that you're playing, that helps simulate and push
the objective is to play a story in a believable world, not to tell a compelling story.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And this, they come at this from a completely different perspective. The rules are not meant to actually simulate the functioning of the world. The rules are explicitly there to create narratives and narrative outcomes. So they're very, the language is absolutely directed in this. It's saying, this is a fiction first game. If the rules are getting in the way, always make the best decision for the fiction. Talks about, this is a game of collective storytelling. You are all telling a story together collaboratively. And so it is fundamentally broken the entire way, because they're putting the cart before the horse. The role playing is, there's no script, and everyone's played in the railroad games. Everyone's run in railroad games. I've done that before. There's nothing less satisfying than that. And when you finally get into a game where you have freedom and agency to really make choices, and the DM respects your choices, and you play out the consequences of them,
there's no going back.
Yeah, there's, you can't,
there should be no going
you
back.
Can't go back after that.
Yeah.
And this game is explicitly, it is explicitly about the end state of telling that cool story.
Yeah.
And I could talk a lot about different specific aspects of it, but I don't want to, I'll just monologue for the next 40 minutes.
Well, but the thing that gets me about it, it's so far in the story thing. Like, it's so far down that story rabbit hole that it's completely forgotten that there actually has to be some kind of mechanic tied to making things happen.
Right.
And I've heard people talk about, there's been part of the discourse has been, is this a ripoff of Blades in the Dark or not? And I can tell you whether or not it's a ripoff of Blades in the Dark, at least Blades in the Dark is a playable experience.
Yeah.
It's a complete game.
It is a game, at least, from what I understand. I haven't read Blades, but we got a lot of comments of people telling us that, you know, like, Blades does it better in this respect. They have this thing called, like, it's like positioning and decision or something. I don't remember what it was. But it sounds very much like they took a couple of ideas from Blades and took the dice pool from it and really just put something out as fast as they could.
Yes. Right. This will be good enough. Let's slap it together. Right.
People will buy it.
Because there are complete story games. Blades in the Dark is one. Powered by the Apocalypse is another. The storyteller system, certainly in its latest incarnation, leans heavily into the storytelling mechanics. So even setting aside the fact that we believe that that narrative approach is putting the cart before the horse, with Candela Obscura, they've come at it from the approach, okay, we're here to tell a story. How do we tell a story in this medium? Well, we haven't thought about that at all. So we're going to just take the creative writing 101.
Yeah.
Like bullet points, you know, rising action, falling action, epilogue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These are real things in literature and in movies and in other types of stories. But there's been no thought, no development, no even awareness that those tenets, which may work or fulfill some kind of function in a different medium, because the goal is just let's tell a story like an HBO show, like a movie.
More like a Netflix show in this
case. More like a Netflix show. More like a Tubi show.
Yeah.
You know.
CW show.
Yeah.
CW show. We'll just do precisely what they did in the most watered down way possible.
And he's not exaggerating here. Like the GM section of the book
explicitly tells
you. How to construct scenarios. It's like, okay, you're going to start with the cold open and then you're going to have the call to action, basically, where they, you know, you get your assignment and then you're going to have exploration phase one. And then you'll do another scene of exploration after that. And you got to give your players these clues. But you have to make sure there's one clue that can tell them how to get to the end.
This would
be
atrocious advice if you wanted to write a movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's unbelievable. I was reading it. I was literally like, my jaw dropped. I was like, this is the worst advice I've ever encountered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've got questions here in chat. Arn Man here has a question. Was Candela Obscura well playtested? The short answer is no. But the long answer, I think, is a little bit more telling, because this was quote unquote played on Critical Role.
Right.
But based on the way that their actual play, if you even want to call it that, kind of based on the evidence that we're seeing here now, went, it's clear that they weren't playing the same game that they're now selling.
No. Yep. And the thing is, they even in their own promotional material admitted that they had already started filming the first episode of that show before the book was even complete.
Mm-hmm.
And there were things they also admitted that, you know, in the game, it says, you know, if you want to do player versus player combat, that's not a part of this game. And you'll have to come up with rules for that on your own if you want. So that was hilarious when I read that, because it was like, that's, you know, I paid you to tell me how to play this game, not for me to make it up. But they said that, and it's not a remote edge case, because it came up on the show, and the guy who wrote the book was the DM or the storyteller or whatever, and had to make up a rule on the spot on how to resolve player versus player combat.
Yeah.
So it absolutely was not playtested, and it was not even done before they started making this giant commercial for it, basically. So from my opinion, it is an extraordinarily cynical cash grab. And the thing is, it didn't have to be. They could have they could have waited another couple of months and really just adapted Blades in the Dark to this game.
Yeah. Or anything.
Or anything.
Anything.
Yeah. They could have made a D20 system with this.
They could have made a D20 system and it would have been better. I think, you know, the sense I get, I haven't been as heavily into it as you have been in taking the lead on that video.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that they were overly confident in having the success of this product be carried by name recognition and
just the
genre of it. People people like Ren Faire steampunk occult investigation.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they will buy it regardless of what it is. It is ultimately about, I mean, I think that to them it is mostly about just playing make believe in the absence of all any and all rules. So
it's like doing a one of those like murder mystery parties at home,
right? You know?
But even those probably have rules, I assume. I've never done those, but that's
they do. You know, they have rules.
Okay, so it's not like that.
Yeah.
But I think the most egregious thing though about this, it's like the lack of a. It's not even that it lacks a combat system, but it's supposed to be a horror game, and it can theoretically be deadly. But they have it literally tells you there's no rational means of calculating damage when players are getting harmed. Like a player, the monsters don't attack you. It's when you take an action, if you fail, it's like, okay, now is an opportunity when the monster would deal you some damage. And they basically just tell you, make it up. You know, you just give out some marks on body. Don't be afraid to hit them hard because they are protected through this other system called scars. But it's like, how can I as a game master make a fair call? You know, because at that point it is just completely, I'm just making it up. It's whose line is it anyway? You know, like it's all made up and the points don't matter. So I can't see that from my perspective. That is not a satisfying experience at the table, because if my character dies, I want to know that they died according to specific, there's an actual process for that to be determined how that happened. Or if I live, you know, like I don't want to think that the GM is just looking out for me all the time. I hate that.
Right.
Yeah. Part of the role of the players at the table is to check the GM on the rules. And so that's why it's important for players to know rules as well.
Yeah.
James Streisand and I talked about that a couple weeks ago. But with this system, there's literally no, like, there's just no rule for it.
Yeah. So.
Well, not only that, like, to me, when you were telling me about this, that's bad. But to me, that isn't even the worst part of the system. It's the fact, not only is there no rule for damage or any kind of harm befalling the characters, but no opposing force is even capable of threatening a character unless and until the character fails at a proactive action.
Right.
To be in a horror situation, to be in a horrific, terrifying situation, there must therefore be a threat.
Yeah.
Whatever it is. And if nothing can threaten me, if I know there's the monster, there's the thing, if I don't do anything to it, or if I stack all the odds in my favors that I have a 98% guarantee, you know, that nothing bad will happen to me. You know, it's like playing a video game. It's like stun locking a mob in a video game.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely atrocious.
And for people watching, the way this works is that the GM does not roll dice in this game. It's all on the players. So the player can, you know, get an outright success. They can get a mixed success that has some sort of cost or complication, or they can have an outright failure. And when you fail or have a mixed success, that's when you might take damage from enemies. But the enemies are not making attacks against you. And so if you had, like, you know, a security guard, a night watchman who is trying to shoot you, they're probably going to be a lot worse at that than someone who's like a veteran soldier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't matter, because in this game, there's there's the enemies, there's no stats, there's no way really for them to act. And people in our comments did bring up, like, Well, you could say that the soldiers are shooting at you, and now you have to try to escape that somehow. So you could dodge or I don't know, take cover or something like that, and roll the dice that way. But it's still like that is not the enemies having any sort of grounding in simulation in the world. And
right, the artificiality of it all is
totally
like
right
to the forefront.
Totally unacceptable.
Yeah, and I'm this whole thing, even kind of like going back to the Blades in the Dark part of this,
mm-hmm.
Forged in the Dark is just like it's a thing that you can just put on any book. It doesn't cost anything mm-hmm. to stick that little logo on your book. If Critical Role went to Evil Hat, who distributes Blades in the Dark, and said, we're doing a Forged in the Dark game, they would literally like bend over backwards and fully like fold themselves up into pretzel people just to work with Critical Role over at Evil Hat. So I don't understand what any of this was, and John Harper's name would have been kind of raised. I'm not a fan of Blades in the Dark. I'm really not a fan of Evil Hat, but it seems like that would have been just preferable to hiring whatever jabroni it was they hired as the game designer
on
this some thing. Creature.
It's really bad too, because they said that this system, the Illuminated World system is what it's called, has been in development for quite a while. And this is the first game that uses it. And it's like, what did you develop? This is, it's you took the core mechanics from a different game. And they do credit the Blades in the Dark creators. And they list a bunch of other games that are references, like inspiration for them. But it's like, what was under development? Like there's almost nothing here, and you didn't come up with it. And I'm not against people using like an off the shelf system like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Making a game from scratch sounds really hard, right. You know, but the fact that it's kind of like they're saying it's their own system, and it's like, no, it's just a half baked version of someone else's rules. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it feels very dishonest.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it feels to me like a flat out lie born out of arrogance and incompetence.
Yeah. That too. It is extremely incompetent.
And Iron Man has a question here in chat. Will the stream of Candela Obscura hurt the Critical Role channel? This is an interesting aspect of the discussion, because I think right now it won't, at least not immediately, because there's still brand loyalty. For some reason, the critters are still like none of them are willing to kind of see the truth on this, which, you know, the evidence can be found kind of in no better place than the reaction to Indestructible Boy, Kablooey the Pirate's review of this game and the way that just the fan base went rabid on him. For honestly, just basic criticism, like objective criticism of what's wrong with the game.
Yeah, it's like imagine saying, you know, I really just don't like Pepsi Zero.
Yeah.
And then people being like, how dare you criticize Pepsi? Yeah. You know, it's like, it's just a product.
But I mean, that's the thing. You know, these people don't have actual senses of taste or aesthetic.
Yeah.
They just have brand loyalty. And I think that's why I think I would agree with you that this isn't going to meaningfully. It's not a grievous wound to the Critical Role brand, because even though you are getting some criticism, even from the shills out there, it's the reaction, at least that I've seen, it's not like the OGL reaction or anywhere near that level. And part of that is because there are only two corporate brands which are viable to these people, and that's Hasbro or Critical Role. And because Hasbro is still an enemy right now, it has, you know, what's that phrase? It has you know, not friend smell, but enemy smell.
Yeah, yeah.
To it. Critical Role, you know, is ballasted by that.
Yeah. I think that I don't know that it's going to have a long-term effect on their show or anything like that, but it makes me for their next game, I was actually hoping that their D&D knockoff, the whatever it was, Daggerheart. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was hoping that that might actually be a decent system and really maybe take a chunk out of the WotC player base, some level of getting the WotC player base out of that, just to get some more distribution across the people playing different games. But this game is so poorly done, and the same game designer that made this one is making Daggerheart, that I think they'll sell a lot of copies initially. No one is ever going to play that game.
Yeah,
no, right. People are not going to play this game for very long. I know there's some people on Reddit that are playing it very poorly, and some of them even kind of vindicating things that I said in the video. But they, it's just going to sit on people's shelves, I don't wish for bad, you know, bad stuff to happen to Critical Role or anything like that. Like I think the entertainment product is fine for the people that it for their target audience, but.
I'd rather have more good products.
I would rather have more good games out there, and I don't care who makes them. You know,
yeah.
If someone makes a good game, that's awesome. I want more good games out there.
Yeah. Well, and where I think this will kind of not immediately hurt Critical Role, but in the long run hurt Critical Role. Once Daggerheart is available, Daggerheart is a little bit more kind of mainstream to the branding of Critical Role. Candela Obscura is still very much
it's a
thing
niche.
To the side. It's a niche.
For sure.
Daggerheart is targeting kind of a larger portion of their audience. And once it's available, the implication will be that, you know, this is the game that powers Critical Role. So this is the game that you can use to create Critical Role at your table.
Right. And they'll never say that explicitly, but that is the implicit message. Yeah.
But go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, just what I think is going to happen there is once that game is out and people start kind of en masse trying to replicate Critical Role and failing because they don't have the tools there, I think there's going to be a little bit of antipathy towards the Critical Role cast because they sold their consumer base of bill of goods at that point. Now, I know this is relying on people having kind of good consumer sense and actually reading the rule book, but I think there will be enough people who try to replicate Critical Role using their quote unquote house rules that will realize it's impossible and then realize, wait, this isn't actually a game. This is a facade of a game. This is an entertainment product that masquerades as a game. And then I think that's going to upset people.
I don't think that's the case.
Well, I think that they're not, it's not even that they're not going to be able to replicate Critical Role. They're not going to be able to replicate their fight with what they were doing with 5e.
Yes.
But that's the thing. I don't really see, unless they make a significant public relations blunder. I don't think a poor or a middling game or an incomplete game is going to meaningfully change the bottom line or the relevancy of Critical Role, because A, people have already been trying to replicate Critical Role with 5e for years. Because they were using 5e and still are using 5e. And, you know, the fact that you can't exactly replicate the same thing has not dawned on people. I don't think that is even in their awareness.
If
it didn't piss them off, the consumer base yet, it's not going to with the new game. And B, because the consumer base for Critical Role is a media. It's a television product.
Yeah, it's a TV show.
And the consumers of Critical Role are predominantly a television audience customer base, not a tabletop role-playing customer base. Yeah. Obviously, there's a significant overlap here. But at the end of the day, as long as they keep making a compelling show, they will remain in the limelight. And they will continue to do that for as long as sort of nerd chic is is the ascendant, like, mass media touchstone.
It needs to be not cool to play these games anymore.
Yeah, it has to not be cool.
It has to go back. We have to go back.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand here, because I've got, there are people in chat asking about it. Calvinoni here specifically is asking about MCDM, wondering if it'll hurt his brand. I do Bogle's actually think... Brand? Yes.
Okay.
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, I see where you're coming from on the Critical Role point, and how it's already kind of seen more as a TV show rather than a game. Matt Colville specifically styles himself as a game designer, and he's coming from the like serious game design world. He's designed video games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If
he doesn't make a good game, it will hurt him more.
For sure.
Yeah. If his game does not hold up under its own weight.
Yeah.
Especially
given the length of time he's asking people to,
to have
faith in it. And long as this, what is it supposed to be, 800 pages across two books, which seems absurd to me. I mean, that's a big ask. And he is not a television production crew.
We did both just spend like $200+ on Axe, though. So.
That's true. That's but different. That was a good
that
game.
That is different. Yeah, the game we already have.
And we didn't have to wait until 2025 for it.
Right.
We haven't. Exactly. Well, we have the PDFs.
We have the PDFs.
Well, we have two out of three
PDFs. Yeah.
PDFs.
Yeah.
Yep. And I don't think MCDM has a Poplar slipcase. So
they don't. Yeah. And they never will.
Who else can? Now?
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
All the poplar wood in the world has been depleted to make slipcases.
McCree's played the arbitrage game.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing is, I think you're right, Colville. It would hurt him a lot more if his game didn't do well and people didn't like it. Yeah. However, I do think that he's going to have a well-oiled game. Like, the game will be a game.
That seems legitimately to be his interest. Now, I am positive the game is not going to suit my taste.
Oh, yeah. It's not going to be something that I like, but it will be a game.
Yeah, I don't have a lack of faith that...
This is not really
a game. This is not really... Yeah, that's not really a game. That seems to be what Colville legitimately is excited and interested in doing.
Yeah.
And I'm fairly confident he'll make...
More money.
A compelling and certainly... Well, maybe not a compelling to me, but like at least a very complete game that will deliver on its premise.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be kind of like a 3E, 4E...
Heroic fantasy.
Heroic fantasy tactical, sort of combination thing. But, I mean...
Who knows?
You know, people have gotten it wrong before. Yeah. Many, many, many people have gotten it wrong before.
Yeah.
So, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, this... honestly, this game, Candela Obscura, it's just... I'm almost having trouble putting into words, like, how much of an unforced error this whole thing has been.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It did not at all have
they to had everything the everything going for them.
Right.
Yeah. Everything going for them to succeed. And it was only because, again, I think of the arrogance and the legitimate incompetence. This shows the lack of validity of their mindset, that this is just, oh, do what you want. You know, it's fiction first.
Right.
As, you know, not realizing that those words don't mean anything if you don't define them.
Right. And the reason that people get these great memorable stories out of the games is because the games
they have to
were
be
designed first.
Something.
Yeah.
Right.
It's definitely that. And it's basically showing really poor judgment on their part that I literally can't believe that they released.
Yeah. It is astonishing
in this state
that nobody said no to this.
Right.
It almost comes across as like, can we take a crap in a box and put our logo on it and sell it to people?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I don't think the thing is, I don't think they did it maliciously in that sense. It's just that
they don't have the guile, I don't think, for that kind
villainy?
Of
villainy. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they're not that smart. I think they're legitimately just like, they're just stupid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's probably the most.
They're likely. More stupid than they are malicious. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
You're probably right about that.
Yeah. I think that's probably it. It's just that this is, yeah, it wasn't play tested. We essentially know that. I think they probably assumed, oh, we're using Blades in the Dark. That's already been play tested.
Just right. Slap, it's done.
Yeah. Throw it into the mm-hmm. lore we've created. Cause that is something they also said, was that like the designer said that when he came in, he was hired to design the game portion of this for an already existing property, meaning that they had already created Candela Obscura, the world and the mm-hmm. ethos and this aesthetic that they wanted for it, and lore, I'm assuming, and said, go put some rules together for this. So I don't know. I'm a big believer that the rules and the setting need to inform each other the entire time, and it's hard to just graft something onto a setting without it changing. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really all there is to say about Candela Obscura. I mean, it's it's not a good game, and no. I imagine in the next 3 months it will in fact be Obscura. I think most people will forget that this thing even existed.
Agreed.
Now, something that is not Obscura, but something that still constitutes a massive misstep on the part of the producers. Young Steve, you recently put out a video on the Black Lodge channel mm-hmm. about Vampire the Masquerade. This is the fifth edition.
Yep.
I am not well versed in Vampire, with the exception of having played Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines.
Mm-hmm.
So I know a little bit about the Camarilla and the various clans and all that stuff. But something that I found really interesting about your video was the approach you took about generations and generational media.
Yeah.
I've been particularly hard on Gen X in my kind of personal musings, and I have my reasons for that.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. Yes.
But you brought out a good point that there is something quintessentially Gen X about the original Vampire the Masquerade, and unfortunately there's something quintessentially millennial about fifth edition. So talk a little bit about that and kind of what, unfortunately, our generation has done to Vampire.
And to many other things.
Yes.
Yeah. The original iteration of Vampire, I think it came out in 89. It was so fully a representation by accident, by organic happenstance. it really captured the feeling of the 90s, mm-hmm. particularly the early to the mid 90s.
Yeah,
and a lot of its themes of rebellion. It had a very strong, very identifiable black and white aesthetic. Mixture of sort of the dark romanticism of goth and that aggressive, in your face, transgressive, offensive. Punk aesthetic as well, not only in the art, but in how, but in the writing, in how the world was portrayed, how the characters were sort of put over, and in how, like, the organization of the vampiric underworld really, really operated.
Yeah.
That was incredibly resonant. It was incredibly popular in its day. You know, they had it's not well known now, but there was a Vampire the Masquerade TV show.
Yeah.
There was a WWE wrestler named Gangrel. You know, there was a bunch of, it was a tremendously popular, and people had t-shirts and memorabilia
on
them. It was a product of that moment in time, and it was riding the energy of the 90s, of that period in history. And when the 90s was over, when these sort of themes ultimately became played out, no climactic or cataclysmic change happened by the time.
By 2000.
By 2000, by the time the millennium came around, the world had already changed so much. The internet was now so much more of a thing. Magazines and written publications were, starting to fade or continuing to fade away. The internet changed
literally the world everything in
innumerable ways. Technology and the interconnectivity of everything and everyone, that was really, I would say, a main driving force of the 2000s. So all that being said, the 90s died, and with the death of the 90s, so too did Vampire die. Now, in 2018, they released a newer edition. The latest edition, White Wolf, was bought out or purchased. White Wolf was purchased along with, it was purchased from whoever owned it previously by Paradox.
CCP and then
CCP, the people who do EVE Online. Purchased White Wolf and all of its properties and tried to create the game again, create a new edition. But to their credit, the people who designed the game did know on some level that you can't just re-release the world, the game as it was, and expect it to resonate.
Yeah.
Right.
The 90s are over. Goth is dead. Punk is dead. All of these things are cringe and anachronistic now. So they tried to fit Vampire into the current world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the current world we're living in is chained down and bound in by so many conflicting forces, and the desire to bring anything back that was beloved from the past is ultimately like a cannibalistic urge. Obviously there are Gen X people who were intended to purchase the new edition of Vampire. And in fact, a significant portion of the writing is like exclusively aimed to them, which is bad for getting new readership. But the impetus, the forces, the incentive structure that manifests these changes in the world it's a product of this cannibalistic nerd urge.
And specifically millennial.
It's a millennial thing. Even if Gen Xers themselves are designing the game by and large,
right,
and it's a millennial spirit that is like animating this process. And so you see, what was quasi-offensive or edgy just be snarky, ironic, self-referential. There's this desire to clean everything up and sort of make it universally balanced.
Yeah.
Obviously,
turn
see
it
that.
Into the iMac. It's like this nice smooth bar of soap thing.
Yeah, nothing is really offensive. Yeah. Nothing is too confusing. Everybody's in their sort of separate camps. It's understandable. You can look at it. You can look at a flowchart, or you can look at a splatter point map. And sort of like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Which is the complete antithesis of this messy punk goth aesthetic kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's they did a good job. That is that like that is yep. where that is where we are.
They made another time capsule.
They made yep. another yeah. time capsule. It's just everything sucks so much for all of these reasons. You can't get a game. You can't get a creative product that yeah. isn't going to like be severely flawed.
Yeah.
In some way.
And
so,
and we were talking about this the other day too, because it's like I love Vampire, but I have found myself less enamored with it recently just because the world sucks more than it used to. And it's like,
right.
He made the point.
The real world is more dark.
Yeah. It's like, we live in the world of darkness now. Like, so.
Well, and this is the thing about what I would want from a modern vampire game is for someone to have the wherewithal and the balls to kind of explore what a secret society of vampires would be like in the 2020s.
Yeah.
Right.
We have plenty of examples of secret conspiracies of people doing shady things.
Yeah.
I don't need to name them. You all have ones that have popped into your mind immediately.
Yeah.
Imagine those, but it's vampires.
Yeah.
Imagine like a catfish situation, but instead of catfishing someone, you're essentially setting up an anonymous familiar for yourself. Yeah. You're setting up a human to do your dark bidding in the daylight just through the internet instead of having to seduce them one. Like there's all kinds of ways you could kind of make a cool 21st century vampire game.
Right.
But the people who are in charge of this IP are interested in doing absolutely none of that.
Right.
Well, here's the
Here's the thing. The 21st century vampire game has been made.
Yeah.
And that is Vampire the Requiem, which was the new World of Darkness. So at the end of the 90s, the World of Darkness comes to an end. White Wolf, each game line had an apocalypse scenario at the end. They made those products. The world is over. They rebooted and created the new World of Darkness, and everybody hated it except for me because it got rid of it. It reinterpreted all the myths. It was a new world. Basically, it's a separate thing. Requiem and Masquerade have no crossover with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone hated it because it wasn't the old World of Darkness.
It wasn't the old thing.
Right. But it was a game that was much more suited to the 21st century. Just in the way that even down to mechanics, like, you know, now vampires, if they appear in a mirror, are like blurred. It's the same thing if they're on camera. There's something always wrong with the footage, and then they eventually fade. So in a world that is now completely surveilled, you know, the assumptions of Vampire the Masquerade make no sense.
Yeah.
And so that game, and it's a much more, there's no meta plot to it. There's no overbearing lore that you have to deal with. It is a much more kind of an open sandbox style of game that has a lot more mystery to it. And the sad thing is that everyone hated it and with a little bit of truth to it, it lacked identity when it first got released, but it was about halfway through the first edition. It really, really, they found its identity and it got awesome. And they released a second edition in 2013 or 2014. That is phenomenal.
It's an excellent game.
Yeah, it's an excellent game. And thankfully, Onyx Path is no longer allowed to make books for it, or at least they're not releasing anymore. So they can't go back and
find them. They can't.
Yeah.
Right. So I like that. That's the thing. It's like there are a lot of flaws in the game, and there are a lot of issues you could put at the developer's feet. But you absolutely could. I mean, they did with Requiem, and you could do again. You could imagine a world that has all of the themes and the issues that we all know about right now.
You can keep a lot of the lore intact without.
But I would say you couldn't do that with Masquerade.
Yeah.
It would be something different if it to bring something fully into the 21st century, into right now, into 2023, it requires something fundamentally new. And in trying to drag something from the past into the present moment, there was a balancing act they had to do. I would say they did a pretty damn good job, all things considered. But it's a problem with trying to, with not letting things be dead.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's the same problem with all the other big major nerd franchises.
Mm.
They would still be good. And setting aside even like woke stuff, it's deeper and it's beyond that.
Yeah.
That understandable criticism. Batman, Star Wars, they would be infinitely better if they were allowed to just remain dead. Let them rest in peace. Let them be enjoyable as an eternal touchstone of a particular moment in time.
Right. Yes. Yeah. There's been no drive to create a new vampire, as in something to kind of be this generation's vampire. There's been no desire to, you know, create the next Star Wars or the next James Bond. It's always, you know, the old. We have to go back to something that someone else created and perpetuate it.
We have to rob its grave over and over and over
And over again. And it gets more desiccated
every time.
More jarring every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the millennialism that's inherently in it. That's the millennial drive.
Yeah, because it is honest, and we're millennials, but it's it really is something that is awful about, that at least awful that I find about our generation, is just this need to cling to the things that you loved from the time you were 9 till you were like 17 or 18, you know, and be like, this was cool then. I liked it. I'm still allowed to like it. I'm going to continue liking it. I'm going to keep talking about it forever. You know, it's it's like Vampire Masquerade. Like like it, you know, but
not, I don't want to keep doing the same thing.
Right.
But yeah. The generation has such a lack of vitality in it and such a lack of vision.
It's so
blind. It can't chart a path through the future. And so,
I'm thinking about the Zoomers and it's like, but they're just like schizo.
Yep. Maybe there's some hope in the homeschool, like Giga Chat Zoomer generation. Maybe they'll be the Nietzschean vitalists to save us. But maybe not. And it's either them or truly inhuman desocialized creatures.
No, that's when ChatGPT will save us.
Yeah.
And it's up to the machine.
And that's something that I've been trying to do myself. And I am still a millennial. I'm on the younger end of millennial. I'm kind of like right at the cutoff. I just turned 28. So I'm right on the cusp of millennial. But I'm not Gen Z.
Yeah. Thank God. No, I'm just kidding.
Yes. I look at Gen Z, like I look at core Gen Z, and it's all the stuff that when I saw it, I was just a little too old to appreciate it. And now I'm just like, this is all completely incoherent to me.
Yeah.
Right.
I have never and will never understand the appeal of Lazy Town.
As an example, what that is. Yeah.
and you're better off not knowing.
Yeah.
But probably.
I don't understand. Like, we can look back at the mullet, and the mullet's making a comeback. I know that.
Yeah.
But we can look back at the mullet and say, like, for most people, that was a mistake. I don't get how these Zoomers can look themselves in the mirror with the broccoli haircut.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I don't get it. Like, you're already being memed every single day about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is 10 years from now, you're all going to be horrifically embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But something I've really been trying to do, and something I'm trying to do with the games that I'm now trying to make, is actually create something new.
Yeah.
It has clear influences, but I'm not just trying to, you know, remake Dark Sun or, you know, whatever gaming thing that I enjoyed. I am trying to make something new with my games,
which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that can be done.
Yeah.
Like to recreate, I understand the urge. I get it. But Jesus Christ, like how many clones of Planescape or Dark Sun or whatever the hell it is. Like, like, let it go. Let it go. For Christ's sake, think, let it go.
Think of something else. And it's like you said, like, you have influences. You're not starting from a blank slate.
You can't not have influences.
Yeah, you can't have influences. But it's like, you want to, like, come up with some original twist on something. Yeah. You want to, you know, take or take influences and combine them in a way that hasn't been done before. And we are trying to do that as well. And it's hard. It is, like, it's very hard, but it is something that is definitely needed, and it's an extremely admirable pursuit.
It's the only thing, if you're going to create something, I don't want to go too far with this, but, like, if you make the most proficient recapitulation of whatever, Dragonlance, let's say. This is Dragonlance, but the names of the gods are different, and the Knights of Salamia are now called, you know,
the Knights of Gabagool or something.
Exactly, the Knights of Gabagool.
Yeah.
Which would be great.
Yeah.
No one will remember that.
Yeah.
No one will remember that, and no one will remember you. And that's not to make this hobby sort of more grandiose than it is, because I'm highly skeptical of the of the contention that this is art.
Yeah.
per se. But nevertheless, you know, like, the truth remains that if you're not doing something that is coming from within yourself, or is not trying to reach some kind of higher virtue, whatever, some sort of higher truth, something that is real in the world that hasn't been revealed to your liking, like, what are you doing?
Yeah. What would even be the point?
What is the point?
Right.
Forgotten Realms already exists, and you can play it in any system that you want to. And if you don't like the name of Sirik, you can change it to something else. If you don't like the Harpers, you can change their name to something else, or you can get rid of them entirely, but it's been done. That's been made already.
Yeah, the era of the spiritual successor has done us all
a great disservice. Yeah.
Well, guys, this has flown by, and I've really enjoyed this conversation, but unfortunately we are running up on our time here. I definitely need to bring you guys back on and maybe even do episode just about Vampire.
Yeah, we can talk about Vampire. We both love talking about Vampire. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when your stuff is getting close to seeing the light of day and going out to people, let us know. We'll definitely have you on our show as well.
Yeah, definitely. I would
love to talk to you about it.
Yeah, so my first product is going to be called O Night Divine, and it's a Christmas adventure.
Nice.
It will be releasing on Christmas Day, at least so far.
This year?
Yes.
Nice.
Oh, okay, cool. Releasing on Christmas Day.
It'll be free, so we won't have you on before.
We won't have you on Christmas. Yeah.
Sorry, let's let him plug his thing. Sorry.
Yeah. It'll be available for people to purchase even after that. So if you guys want to talk to me about Nighthaven and kind of the world that I'm creating with my products, I'll be doing a Kickstarter early in 2024.
Awesome.
You know, at some point we can definitely talk about me coming on the show with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Most definitely.
And y'all are welcome on here anytime.
Well, thank you.
Much appreciated.
Yeah, love to come back.
Yeah, this is fun.
Cool. So, guys, that is going to be it for Rolling Bones tonight. Thank you once again, Black Lodge Games, for coming on here. Definitely check them out. I'm going to drop the link to the channel here in chat one more time. And those of you who are watching this after the fact, you will find the link to their channel in the pinned comment beneath this video. This is the last Rolling Bones of 2023. I will be seeing you guys on here in 2024. However, if you have not gotten enough of me talking about gaming and my thoughts on gaming, you can catch me tomorrow night on Talking Crit with Bad Mike and Eric Tankar. I will be on there with the Wonky, who is here in chat. We will be talking all about O'Knight Divine. We'll be talking about his upcoming game, His Heinous Harvest, and the alliance that the two of us have forged as Guts and Glory. So, you know, we'll be talking about all that stuff tomorrow night at 7 p.m. Central over on Talking Crit, which is on the Tankars Tavern channel. So I hope you guys will join me over there. And until next time, whether you rolled a 1 or a 20, I'm so glad that you rolled your bones with me, Ryan Howard. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and I will see you guys in 2024.